ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. If you've ever wondered why people behave the way they do, or what it's like to live inside their heads, this is the show for you. We dive deep each week into a topic related to mental health or psychology, from the promise and perils of manifesting, to how to get better sleep, to what it's like to experience psychosis. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Look, we just decided to drop another little gift into your podcast feed, Russell Crowe and the State of Democracy.
Yes, indeed. And his views on the divisions in our societies that feel so acute right now.
It all has echoes in his latest film, Nuremberg, which I sat down with him to talk about recently.
It's a very interesting reflection from one of our best-known actors. I'm Geraldine Doogue.
I'm Hamish McDonald.
And welcome to a little bonus episode of Global Roaming.
So, Geraldine, Russell Crowe is out spruiking his new film, Nuremberg, in which he plays Hermann Göring, and it certainly is a lot of Oscar chat already.
He's put on 50 kilos for that, I think.
And he delivers the most remarkable performance.
Yeah, he does do, I think, in a film that you could question in some ways, but really his portrayal of Göring, who everyone, I mean, it was well known he's one of the smartest, wittiest men, you know, among Hitler's group. And I think that Crowe does really try to capture that complexity and the narcissism, of course. I think Crowe does really try to capture that very well.
And I suppose, you know, you've obviously travelled to Nuremberg. I was curious about your reflection on that journey.
Oh, look, I really commend to listeners, if you go to Nuremberg, you know, you're over there for some sort of journey, you can go to a marvellous modern museum where they held the war crimes trials. It's a terribly well done museum, posing lots of very good use of video from the time. Honestly, it's spellbinding in my opinion. And they throw questions because, you know, these were trials conducted with no case law, no precedent. It was an extraordinarily game thing that the Allies decided to do, and amazing that they got the Russians on board. You really leave that museum a different person, in my opinion.
What did change for you? What changed in your understanding either of the trials that came afterwards or the crimes committed during the Second World War?
I suppose it was just the gameness that they in setting them up. You know, like a lot of people, and very senior people, just wanted to shoot them. They just wanted to shoot these. They sort of thought
the Nazi
they were
leaders.
The Nazi leaders. You know, they'd been captured, but other heads prevailed, and we've got, therefore, this remarkable digest of how a country like Germany, an advanced country like Germany, descended into what it did.
Yeah, perhaps we should just set up for listeners before we get to Russell Göring. Obviously, you will know the name, but he was the second in charge, essentially, to Adolf Hitler, the Reichsmarschall, they called him. And after Hitler's death, it was assumed, essentially, that he was the top of the pile, as it were, amongst the Nazis. And this film follows him through the judicial process.
It does. Yeah. And I think you learn, you know, as you and I have discussed, I've got some quibbles about some of the casting of people in this film, but I do think you get a sense nothing is simple when the notion, and that's one of the very strong things I got from it, it just fundamentally altered my view again about the politics of the build-up to war. You know, we've received a very, I think, somewhat sort of, I don't know, simple, you know, open and shut story on that. It's much more complicated, and we need to know it in order to work out where we are now in the world.
And in a sense, that's where I started this conversation with Russell Crowe, by asking him about how conscious he was of the film resonating in this moment, in this particular global moment.
I think it's very interesting that if this movie had come out 10 years ago, you would have been able to look around the world and find points of alignment. 20 years ago, you would have been able to do the same thing. 10 years from now, if the movie comes out, you'd be able to do the same thing. And I think that's speaking to who we are as humans, you know. There's a quote at the end of the film, which I think is so interesting and important. You know, if you want to know what human beings will do in the future, just look at what human beings have done. for all of our big step forwards technologically and the way we can connect with each other, and you can carry a universe in the palm of our hands and ask, have every question answered, but we still go through this process with each other as human beings across the planet where we consider that war is a solution to something. It just blows my mind that we can be so forward-thinking in so many areas and just so base and stupid in other areas. For sure, you know, if you want to, like, view what happens in this film as a piece of, you know, which is purely a piece of art, but if you want it to, you know, take you through that process of connecting the dots, there's going to be a lot there for you because it really is a discussion of humanity and the solutions that we come to, which, you know, can be very dark.
So you play Goering. He's a narcissist. He's the Reichsmarschall, the second in command to Hitler, designated successor. But it seems to me that, you know, really the focus of the film is this relationship, the dynamic with the US military psychiatrist who's played by Rami Malek. And you obviously have gone to great lengths to display some of the character traits which this guy had within him: funny, charming, friendly, at the same time as being able to deliver, you know, the worst atrocities of the last century. How important is it for you that we can see that all of those things existed within those people?
Well, look, we've been told over and over and over that charm is one of the greatest weapons of evil. And, you know, people can fall for snake charmers and they can do incredible sort of damage to themselves and to the community around them because they believe in an image that is not based on a reality. So, yeah, I definitely wanted to show, because there's always that question that comes up, right? You know, what were the German people thinking? We put so much pressure on them as a community at that time. You go, how could you possibly agree to this? The thing is that they didn't. It's so incremental, and it's a step at a time and a step at a time. And, you know, and you have people like Herman, who is, you know, when you look back through his life, fascinating, fascinating person. You know, he literally grew up in a castle. He was an absolute failure at school to the point where, as a punishment, they sent him to military school, which is a place he thrived. And he went from being the bottom of the class to the top of the class. When Hermann Goering is a young man, 18, 19-year-old young man, he's a mountain climber. There are traverses in the Austrian Alps where he was the first person to do that. You know, he goes into the First World War straight out of military school as an infantry officer, has one experience on the battlefield, gets wounded, says, I don't want to do this anymore, looks at the planes flying overhead, said, that's me, and then connects himself against orders to the local flight of the Air Force at the time and learns how to fly. So when they get into a deeper part of the war and they're losing pilots left, right, and center, he's able to put his hand up and go, well, I can fly. So he then converts into the Air Force. He finishes the First World War with 22 confirmed kills. That's three times a fighter ace. And he's in control of Baron von Richthofen's squadron, the Red Baron squadron. He is on cigarette cards in Germany in the 1920s. He's a public figure. He's a known figure. And he moves towards politics, I believe, with, you know, purely good intentions, patriotic intentions, you know, to help his country that has now been devastated by the Treaty of Versailles, right? So you have this guy. He has, you know, this history. His positive intentions. He wants to be a politician. He gets himself involved with people that can take him to where he wants to go fastest. But here's the problem. You lie down with dogs, you're going to get fleas. And you can see him trying to control the narrative. When you look back through the text, you can find, you can even get, man, right, the Hansard of German Parliament House. So I'm able to read stuff, you know, that's sort of like, it's Goering speaking into, he's got other people, you know, big famous names within that Reich in front of him, and he's laying down the law or castigating people or whatever. You can see who he is as a person. You know, the entire transcript of the court in Nuremberg is available. It was put together by some Australian in Northern Queensland right? I had a mate who was up there on a fishing trip who goes into some little store, goes, what's this book, right? And the whole transcript is available. He bought it for 10 bucks or whatever, brought it back to me. He said, I thought you'd be interested in this. It was so invaluable. I was able to show it to Michael Shannon and go, this is actually the point-to-point of everything that was said. And we were able to see that his character, unlike the other times that this sort of movie about this subject has been done, the American prosecutor didn't win the day. Mm. It was the English guy.
Comes in the last minute.
To take that back to Jamie and go, this is very interesting. So, you know, I'm not sure what the question was to begin with.
It's quite all right. There's a couple of moments in the film that I kind of wanted to draw together and ask you about. One is when Goering's explaining about Hitler and the way the Nazis ruled, that the anti-Semitism served a practical purpose. It was to bring towards them
the dark
men
line.
Who needed something else to focus their emotions, something else to blame.
You remember that very well.
Yeah. And then he also talks about, you know, they had this mandate for change and that democracy had brought forth men who were too weak. Mm-hmm. And it's those two parts of the story spoke really clearly to me in this moment now where there is this kind of hyper-masculine rhetoric, but also clearly a desire for politics to speak to kind of men's emotions.
You lost me a little bit there, but let's go back to the thing where a democracy had created men too weak. Look at what we do from a media perspective to everybody who comes along who is showing some signs of potentially being a good politician, a good community leader. We put these people under so much pressure. We dissect them and we chop them down and we, you know, and even when we don't find anything real on this person, we seem fine to sort of imply negatives or make up stuff. And I mean, it's
like what?
Well, take any political figure that comes forward. The like dissection and ridicule is the first stage of any progress. And is that the way we do it? Is that going to create an environment where people who would have talent for that want to actually get involved? I think that's the problem. We create such a murky place that people step into if they want to go be in public life that we deflect the people who actually got the talent for it. And we end up with, as was stated in the movie, you know, we've brought forth weaker men because we have to go through this process where every single thing has to be agreed to by the majority, as opposed to what we all have grown up with, you know, where it was okay to still have respect for a politician, even if you thought differently to that person's politics or the platforms of their party. You know, I mean, I know many people from my childhood who were dyed-in-the-wool liberal voters who still like Gough Whitlam, as an example, you know? And I think we've lost that. You know, we have to chop things up and make it so black and white and so, you know, binary as an experience that it's either good or bad, you know, or complete or completely useless, that I think we've actually gone away from the nuance of humanity to begin with. We're not all black and white. We're not red or blue. Quite often we're very many mixtures of these things, and that is where our politics is leaving our community behind a little bit. But it's partially to do with how we display and report on it.
Yeah, after watching the film, I went back and read your eulogy from the John Laws funeral last week, and you're talking about the same thing there in a way, this idea that you had this friend that you disagreed with on pretty much everything, I think everything. You said from bike lanes to politics, yeah. And yet there was something there you had in common. And I guess I'm hearing from you this concern that we're losing our capacity to do that. And I guess I heard echoes of that in the film.
And I think the words of division, you know, that we've allowed ourselves to begin conversations with, it's so unhealthy. You know, the history lesson for this is, I think, you know, do you remember those things when we were kids? Probably I'm a bit older than you, actually. So, but there were these magazines, Australasian Post was one, and things like this, you know. And those, the articles in those magazines got more and more extreme, right? Because they're talking to an audience that, you know, they've decided has a short attention span or whatever. So they put in these stupid headlines. It's, you know, half man, half wolf or whatever, you know, these headlines, you know. And that tabloid language because of its, you know, desire to get a reaction and getting a reaction, so it becomes the thing that people discuss that day. You see the Half Man, Half Wolf article, blah, blah, blah. It comes into our daily newspapers and that tabloid language. Then those daily newspapers, then it sort of creeps through all of media where we have to sort of talk in these ways. And I put this all firmly at the feet of Mr. Murdoch, allowing the degradation of the level at which these conversations take place, you know? So now it's all just loud voices, you know, and voices of division. And, you know, we haven't done the right thing in terms of people who run social media platforms and making them responsible for the content that they carry. And, you know, we're doing a rear guard action on that. But where's that going to get? You know, I'm not quite sure. But it's a job that should very definitely be approached. So I think when I can, Hamish, you know, I like to talk against words of division. And I like to talk about the simple thing of, like, it's just like your relationship with your mum and dad. You're not necessarily going to agree with every single thing that your mum and dad believe in or say, you know, but they're still your mum and dad, you know. And that kind of attitude about, like, when you broaden it a little bit wider, is your community. That's your neighbour and people you might meet, you know. It's sort of, I think it behooves all of us to work against the words of division, because it just makes our lives better.
And I was actually reflecting on that. I listened to parts of your Joe Rogan interview over the week, and I didn't have 3 hours, so my apologies, it wasn't the whole thing. But you clearly take this as a personal responsibility, because you're making the time to go and talk across all of those lines to very different audiences about different ideas. I saw you talking about Albo's Joy Division T-shirt to Joe Rogan's podcast audience. I mean, this is a really interesting thing you're doing, I think.
Well, I think we're in a very important turning point sort of place in the way that we regard each other. And, you know, I think more so here than I've seen in other places, I think we're really aware of it here. And so, you know, if I go on a thing like, you know, a Joe Rogan thing, to if I really purely express my true politics, that crowd's not going to listen to me, you know. But if I talk to it in a way which I haven't already turned them off by making some broad political statement, maybe they don't need to listen to me as much as listen to themselves, you know.
When you're in the thick of that and you're thinking, I just want to get home and relax, what's the thing in your mind that you're looking forward to at the end of it?
Exactly what I had this morning, where you wake up in the bush and I get up a little bit before the sun to show it its due respect, and then the bird life, and then the dogs, and the cattle in the distance, and the mist rising over the valley and coming up from the rivers. Yeah, it's, you know, I had a, it's a very funny thing that goes through my mind in a cycle, you know. I made the decision when I was 31 years old to take the money that I had at the time and money that I could borrow from my friend, not a bank, because I'm an actor, and a bank, you don't even get to have the conversation. They go, what's your profession? Quaint. Anyway, so I borrowed money from a friend, and I purchased 100 acres in the bush. I could have, with that same money, bought a nice apartment in the city, but I didn't. So the very first thing, the biggest purchase of my life at that time, was to buy this 100 acres in the bush, no fences, no driveway, a little yellow shack on the hill, some dilapidated farm buildings. And it's something about, and this is prior to me shooting LA Confidential. So I bought the property on the 20th of January, 1996, and then got on a plane and went and made LA Confidential, right? And so that's going to be 30 years next January. And how I knew that I would need an island, a place to just disappear into, I have no idea. But every now and then I stop and I look back at my 31-year-old self and go, well played, young man.
Yeah. I grew up in Jindabyne in the Snowy Mountains, and I'm so grateful that I always have that place to go back to. I open, right. You know, roll the window down, coming around the bend as we reach Jindabyne, you smell in the air, and it's just somehow this kind of immediate cleansing.
You know, I worked in Dinner Plain back in 92 or something like that, right? Which is, you know, sort of just down the road. But I know the feeling, man, because waking up in that environment, you know, especially when it's just got a little fresh blanket, you know, it's amazing. It's, the whole, that area, I'm so glad that people haven't really discovered it because it's still a place of wilderness and adventure.
It's been really lovely talking to you. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Hamish.
Well, that was such an interesting chat with Russell Crowe with you, Hamish. I must say, all of that reflection on his wisdom in buying that property, gosh, I got a lot from that. I thought that was really something.
He was certainly in a reflective mood, wasn't he?
Yes,
I enjoyed that. You know, you can sometimes do these interviews with the big megastars and, you know, they don't actually offer you that much. They're doing so many of these set-piece interviews to spruik their films and it's hard to kind of tease anything fresh or different out of them.
Oh, well, you got that out of him too because he could see that you were intrigued and I thought it was a lovely, you know, a lovely duo, to be candid. And no,
thanks,
I did. So look, that was just a little gift for you, something extra as you go into this sort of mad December season. We'll be back with our final regular episode of the year later this week. It'll be in your podcast feed on Friday and you can hear it on Saturday morning on ABC Radio National.
But we should also point out to you that we're going nowhere over the summer. In fact, we're kind of excited about the special project we've been working on over the last few months that'll be turning up in your podcast feed over summer. What's it called, Geraldine?
Getting Lucky Again. And let me tell you, this has been workshopped, this title. We've invited five experts from across a range of fields to give us their thoughts and ideas for how Australia can not only survive in this changing world, but, you know, truly thrive.
More details to come very soon. In the meantime, keep the emails coming, global.roaming@abc.net.au. Geraldine, see you next time.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.